Alright, so what I'm going to do right now is give an example of an essential discriminant divisor. That is to say, a number field K and prime P, so that P always divides, no matter how you choose an A in the ring of integers, the index of Z adjoin A inside of OK for all A. And the specific example I'll give, P is equal to 2. And here K, in the specific example, is Q adjoin alpha, where alpha is a root of x cubed plus x squared minus 2x plus 8. And the way we'll see that this is the case is that we know from the theorem that we did last time that if this was co-primed to 2, then we could find the factorization of 2ok in terms of prime ideals simply by factoring the minimal polynomial of A, which this polynomial is the minimal polynomial of A, so just write A here. We want to prove this for any A. So this is an example A, but you could choose any A. If you factor the minimal polynomial of A, that should give you the prime factorization of 2ok. But the thing you notice is that, in fact, 2ok factors, if you use the more general algorithm that I discussed, factors as p1 times p2 times p3, where these are distinct. And let me illustrate that for you in Perry right now. Okay, so if we take the number field defined by x cubed plus x squared minus 2 times x plus 8, and we could say ideal, see, k equals n affinet f, then ideal factor k comma 2, we see that it factors as a product of 3 distinct primes. Okay, these are the primes generated by 2 and this particular element in terms of an integral basis, 2 and this element in terms of an integral basis, and 2 and that element at the bottom. So here you have the ideal generated by 2. And the first thing is, so let's figure out what the integral basis is, nf basis f. It's using 1x and 1/2 x squared plus 1/2 x, where x is a root of that polynomial. So an integral basis is, if alpha is a root of this, then it's 1/2 alpha, and 1/2 alpha squared plus 1/2 alpha.
It's just alpha.
Yeah.
Oh, 1/2 alpha squared plus 1/2 alpha is just...
No, it's 1/2 alpha.
You're right. Thank you. Thank you very much. Okay, so that's an integral basis, and in terms of that basis, generators are 2 and... So this is a vector in terms of this basis. It's a linear combination of basis. So we can just write it down as 1 plus 1/2 alpha squared plus 1/2 alpha. That's the first prime ideal. The second one is generated by 2 and 1 plus alpha. And the third prime ideal is generated by 2 and 2 plus alpha plus 1/2 alpha squared plus 1/2 alpha. So I could have put 3 halves alpha. Now, suppose that this index were co-primed to 2. Then you could factor the minimal polynomial of A, and it should factor into 3 distinct factors over F2. And those factors would have to be linear, because the degree of the extension is 3. But you can't. There's no polynomial that factors as 3 distinct linear factors over the finite field of order 2, because there are only 2 linear factors in that finite field. So over a finite field, it can maybe factor as, if it's degree 3 and it splits completely, it could look like this, or like this, or... or that, or this, but in all cases, the prime factorizations of 2 corresponding to these splittings of the polynomial mod 2, they would look like either one single prime that's totally ramified, or a ramified prime and an unramified prime, etc. So that proves that there can't be an A, so that 2 doesn't divide this. No matter which A you choose, 2 has to divide it. Otherwise, you'd have a factorization that... Otherwise, there would have to be a factorization that looks different from this. Okay?
Could you explain that one more time?
Sure. So the claim is the following. 2 divides this for every choice of A. So suppose you have a choice of A for which 2 does not divide that index. Then you can use the theorem from last time, which says that if you take the minimal polynomial of A and then factor it mod 2, that factorization corresponds exactly to the prime factorization of the ideal generated by 2. However, imagine all possible ways that you could factor, more precisely, if you have a degree 3 polynomial and it corresponds to a factorization into 3 distinct primes here, that means that polynomial, let's say f is the minimal polynomial of A, then if 2 doesn't divide this, then this factorization implies that f factors as g1 times g2 times g3 mod 2. So f bar is this product mod 2, where the gi are distinct linear factors.
But
that's a contradiction, because there's only 2 distinct linear polynomials over f2. Okay?
Yep. So there are elements of the set x and x plus 1.
So you can't have this. It's impossible. So this thing is, this ring is not, even at 2, it's not monogenic. It's not generated by one thing. Okay? And a homework problem. Again, the homework is, as usual, stapled in the back of today's notes. One of the homework problems, problem 3, is to find an example of a field of degree at least 4 for which you have this behavior. So basically, find another example like this. That's all. And you might somehow use this one to find another one, or just another. Another homework problem number 4, which if you pay attention to what we do today should be extremely easy, to put it mildly. Problem 4 is to prove that you can always represent a prime ideal in the way that we've done here. That is to say, in the way Perry does, a prime ideal can always be generated by a prime number, an integer, and a single element of the ring of integers. Okay, so we'll prove something along those lines today, and if you look at how the proof works, then you'll see that it implies problem 4 very easily. But if you just look at, say, the statements of the things we proved today, then problem 4 seems very hard. But if you look at the actual proof, then it's very easy. Okay. Problem 5 is to give an example to show that if you take an order instead of the full ring of integers, then you can find an ideal that can't be generated by 2 elements in general. I mean, there exists some order out there in some ring of integers, and it has an ideal in it that can't be generated by 2 elements. I gave exactly this problem last year, and only one student got it, which is kind of surprising. But I phrased it differently as kind of, is it true or not, rather than saying, find a counterexample. But I bet everyone here will have a better shot because of the way I phrased the problem. You just write down an example. You just have to think carefully about how to construct an order like this. problem 1 is to prove the exponent part of what we did last time, namely that if you factor, then these exponents give you the exponents in the factorization. And problem 2 is just an explicit application of the Chinese remainder theorem, which we're going to do today. All right, so we've now done the essential discriminant divisor business. Handed out the notes, homework. All right, so now we're going to talk about the Chinese remainder theorem. So we'll start with this. Everyone here surely remembers the Chinese remainder theorem for integers, which in an algebraic way you can formulate as follows. If you have coprime integers n1 through nr, or by coprime I mean coprime in pairs, that is to say if you take any two, they're coprime. So that's kind of the strongest meaning of coprime you might possibly mean. But given you might misinterpret this as meaning that the GCD of all of them is 1, but I mean that
the GCD of any two is 1. And the two are different. So if they're coprime in pairs, then you have an isomorphism from Z mod the product, the 2, the direct sum of each of the individual quotients. And this is just a way of rephrasing something you might, well, the assertion that if you have a system of congruences, modulo coprime moduli, so a system of congruences, of linear congruences, would be like giving elements of each of these, then there's a unique solution in Z mod the product of the moduli to that system of congruences. So the fact that this is an isomorphism means if you were to, for example, make a system like X congruent A1 mod N1, and you can make slightly more general linear congruences as long as the coefficients of X are units mod Ni. So I'll just N2 and so on. If you have a system of congruences like this, the fact that this is an isomorphism means that, well, you just take the element A1 in the first factor, A2 in the second factor, and so on, and there's some element here that maps to that. So given a system of congruences, there's a unique solution modulo the product of the moduli. And that's so there are two parts to this. One is that the map is injective, and the other one is the map is surjective. And the way you define the map isn't too hard. You first define a map from the integers to z mod n1z, which is just reduction mod n1. Then you define a map from the integers to the sum of all of these, just by taking the direct sum of the previous maps. Then you figure out what the kernel of that is. The kernel of that map from z to the direct sum, the natural map from z to the direct sum, has kernel the intersection of each of these things that you're quotienting out by. So n1z intersect n2z intersect, and so on. And if you have two integers n and m and they're coprime, then what do you know about nz intersect mz?
It's nmz.
Right, it's n times mz. Because what this says is, if it's an nz, it's divisible by n. If it's an mz, it's divisible by m. So the intersection are the integers that are divisible by both n and m. The hypothesis that n and m are coprime means it's the integers divisible by the product. So this intersection is exactly the same as the product n1 through nrz. So there's a natural map given by reduction and then quotienting out by the kernel from z mod n1 dot dot nr is product z to this direct sum. So it's half of the Chinese remainder theorem. The other half is to prove that it's surjective. So let me quickly prove this in the case of just two factors. So I'll prove to you that if n and m are coprime, as is my hypothesis over there, then this map is surjective. And we have a map like this just by reduction and modding out by the kernel. And the way we'll see it's surjective is by noting that you can write 1 as, so because the GCD of n and m is equal to 1, you can write 1 as n times x plus m times y for x and y in the integers. Right, that's just the definition of coprime. The ideal generated by n and m equaling 1 means that there's something in that ideal that's equal to 1. Okay, so you can write this, and then that will give us the surjectivity as follows. So here's what you observe. If you take 1 minus my, then this is equal to nx. And if we reduce it modulo n, what do we get? We get,
to set mod. Going to set mod, and we get one. Okay, you're right. So take this number right here, and let's figure out what it is modulo m and modulo n. So modulo m, it's 1 to 1 mod m. And what is it congruent to modulo n? Oops, I wrote it down. So it's congruent. What is it congruent to modulo n?
0.
Right, okay. So there's a famous number theorist named John Tate. Has anyone here heard of John Tate? Okay, so I was in a car with him a few weeks ago, strangely enough, and I wondered how old he was and when his birthday is. And so I asked him, and he was trying to describe this complicated math problem in which I'd be able to figure out what the day of his birthday was. So he said, I was born on Friday the 13th in 1925. Oh, I gave it away. I mean, this has really happened a few weeks ago. So anyways, if you ever wonder when John Tate was born, Friday the... So he's about to turn 80. This is March, Friday the 13th.
Oh, that's right.
Yep, so 12 days away. Okay, so notice what we've done. We've constructed 1, 0 in the image, and by exactly the same argument, you can construct 0, 1 in the image, and hence you get the whole image. Yes?
For a non-constructive proof, you could just say that the sets have the same size.
Yes, that's right. But it doesn't work so well if the rings are infinite or something, which this argument generalizes nicely to just completely general commutative rings. But yes, that's a good point. You have an injective map between finite sets, and they have the same size, therefore it's surjective. So that works as well. Thank you. Okay, so that's the Chinese remainder theorem for integers. And what we're going to do is we're going to prove the Chinese remainder theorem in total and the generality of an arbitrary commutative ring. Actually, how many people here, has anybody here seen a proof of Chinese remainder for an arbitrary commutative ring? You have?
I had to do it for a problem set.
Okay. Tell me if the argument we have is the same as the one that you used. Actually, there's one detail in the proof that I wrote down in the notes that as I was walking over here, I realized I don't exactly see why it's true. So just to keep those three who have already seen a proof excited, let me just write down a little detail that for some reason I couldn't see it when I was glancing at this, but surely it's right. It's no problem in our case, but here's a statement. Actually, I need a little notation before introducing the statement. So we say two ideals are co-prime if their sum is the unit ideal. Okay? So I and J, ideals in an arbitrary commutative ring R with unity. I and J are co-prime if I plus J is the unit ideal. That is to say, it's R. Okay, and here's a little statement which is probably obvious, but I don't know. Suppose I and J and K are co-prime in pairs. So I plus J is the unit ideal, I plus K is the unit ideal, J plus K is the unit ideal, etc. That imply that I implicitly used this in what I did there, that I is co-prime to J times K. If you've already seen a proof, think about that for a second. Since it's completely obvious in the case of rings of integers, because there you can write each of these as products of primes, and the products of primes that occur in J times K are exactly what?
Isn't kind of like you have elements in each of them is one element.
Yeah.
So that I plus J equals 1.
That's correct. Okay, let's do it. So you have an x and I think this is what you just said, a y and j,
yeah.
So that x plus y is equal to 1. Okay, great. Next, you want to do it with k also, probably?
Yeah.
Maybe I'll come up with, I'll make a notation, so I'll call this x1 and y1.
Yeah.
And then you have x2 and I, y2 and j, so x2 plus y, sorry, not j, but k now.
x2 plus y2 is equal to 1.
And then,
and you also can do that with I and k.
So I think,
I guess you can.
Whether or not this works, I have another method.
Yeah, so then.
Oh, you have another method?
Yeah.
So okay.
Yeah, so you can prove that this coprimality condition is equivalent to being comaximal, which is that, like, they're not contained, no two of them are contained in any one maximal ideal. Like, their ideal sum basically is the whole ring.
That's certainly clear. That one direction of that is clear. If they were contained in a maximal ideal, they clearly wouldn't be coprime in this sense. What about the other direction? So, actually, let's just prove this equivalent. So, equivalent to, you call it comaximal?
Right.
Okay, i.e., there's no maximal M such that I and J are both contained in M. Right?
Right.
Okay, so one direction's clear. Code.
Because the smallest ideal containing both of them is I plus J.
Yeah. IJ coprime implies comaximal. I think that's clear.
Right. And otherwise.
How do you go the other direction?
So if I and J are comaximal,
mm-hmm.
then. Let's see. Well, then I plus.
Oh yeah.
Then that well. If they're right, if they're comaximal,
well,
then their sum
J
has to be the whole ring because they're not contained in a maximal ideal.
I and J are both contained in
M
plus.
That works.
J.
Oh, you're using Zorn's lemma.
Oh.
You're using every ideal is contained in a maximal ideal, aren't you?
I think so. Yeah.
Okay. Good.
Okay.
So for this direction, use Zorn's lemma.
Yeah.
Because you're saying you take the ideal I plus J and it's not maximal.
Oh.
By the moment, I plus J is not maximal. By the comaximality hypothesis.
It's not maximal, so by Zorn's lemma, every ideal is contained in a maximal ideal, so this is contained in a maximal ideal, hence.
Well, I and J can't be contained in a maximal ideal either.
Right.
Right.
I mean, do you.
So.
You could also
wait.
Multiply those, and that will give you what you want.
Okay,
well, let's try it. So, what do you multiply?
Multiply.
Just multiply these two together. You have a 1.
Yeah.
So you have x1 plus y1 and x2 plus y2 is 1 again. And that's also x1, x2. I like this. x1, y2 plus y1, x2 plus y1, y2.
So the last term.
And
so the
last
term
belongs to jk and the first
three
are
I. Belongs to I and the last term. The first.
Okay. What about
the first
the
three?
The,
all
the
first
three
because
you have an x in each
yeah.
case. Okay, excellent.
That works.
Ah, perfect. Okay, good. So when we use this implicitly in the proof, we now know that we've now verified it via simple computation. Okay, and we're going to ignore this because it's not really needed since this is just elementary and gives what we wanted. Okay, but thank you for pointing this out.
Thanks, we don't need to run Zorn's lemma now.
Yeah. All right, so now let's prove the Chinese remainder theorem in the general commutative ring, which in particular will give it to us in the ring of integers. And it's really an incredibly useful tool in the ring of integers in a number field. And the proof is pretty easy in here. So we'll do it in two steps. One is to prove that if, so I guess the lemma is that if you have ideals I and j and they're coprime, then I intersect j is equal to I times j. So first,
could somebody give an example of ideals that are not coprime for which the conclusion is false? Just to show that we really need the coprime hypothesis. Yes?
Let I and j be the ideals generated by 2 and 4 in the ring of integers.
Okay, and then their intersections
is j.
Okay, and their product
is 8z.
Okay. So in the integers, what is nz? In total generality, what's nz intersect mz? Is there some simple formula for that?
Least common multiple of n and mz.
Oops. LCM, I ended up right because. If you're in here, you're a multiple of n. If you're in here, you're a multiple of m. And it's exactly the things that are a multiple of both, which is the least common multiple. So that's how you get the 4. Okay, so we definitely need this hypothesis.
So now let's prove it. One direction is really easy, but it just comes from definition of ideal. Is there an extra copy of the notes that you know? Excellent. Okay, one direction is easy, and it just comes from the definition of ideal. If you're an I times J, then because I is an ideal, you're an I, and because J is an ideal, you're in J, so you're an I to intersect J. So this direction is easy and true in all cases, without any hypotheses. So this, from definition, doesn't require any assumptions. And you'll see that better be true over here, that the product 8z is contained in 4z. And that is true. So this is from the definition, and it doesn't require the hypothesis. So the interesting part is the other direction, and it's not that hard either. So for the other direction, we have to take something in I intersect J, say some element C in I intersect J, and show that it's in I times J. And the way you do that is you just use the definition of coprime. These ideals are coprime, so you can write 1 as something in I plus something in J. So choose X and Y in I and J such that 1 is equal to X plus Y. And now, just take that equation, multiply both sides of the equation by C, and you see that C is equal to something in I plus something in J. So there you are. We've now proved that C is in I intersect. No, we've proved that it's in I times J because.
Because C is in I intersect J. So, like, if X is in I, then C is in J.
You're right. This is an I times J, and this is an I times J. Our C is in I. Our C is in J, so C times X is in I times J. Thank you. Our C is in also in I, so C times Y is in I times J. In each case, this is in I times J. So you get a sum of two things in I times J, so it's in I times J. Okay. So that proves the lemma, and now we're ready to prove the Chinese remainder theorem, which is only a few lines. And the proof is almost exactly like what we did here. By the way, if for amusement, you might want to look at the proof of the Chinese remainder theorem. And there's a guy named Sir Professor Peter Swinnerton Dyer, who wrote a book on algebraic number theory. And he proves the Chinese remainder theorem of rings of integers of number fields in a very, very complicated way. And he gives a proof that only works for rings of integers of number fields. He uses like unique factorization. Very, very complicated. And it's kind of amusing because there's just this much more general result that is really easy to prove. It wasn't so amusing to me last year when I presented it in class, having forgot that there was a much more general Chinese remainder theorem. I mean, it's an example of how if you try to prove a special case of something, the proof can be much more complicated than the appropriate general case. Okay, so here is the proof of Chinese remainder theorem. Okay, so first, the statement, which is a completely general statement, is if you have a ring R, you have ideals I1 through IS and IN plus IN is the unit ideal for all n not equal to m. Then you have an isomorphism from R mod the product of the of these I's. So it's I1 dot 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 IS. That's isomorphic canonically to R mod I1 direct sum R mod I2 direct sum dot 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 direct sum R mod I sub S. And the proof will be exactly like for the integers that I gave, which is first, you have a map from R to each R sub I sub N, which is just reduction modulo of that ideal, and you put together those maps, and you get a map from R to the direct sum, R mod I1, direct sum, dot, 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 direct sum, R mod IN. Okay, now, we have to figure out what the kernel is, so we do that. The kernel is the intersection of I1 with I2 up through IN. That's the kernel of this map. The kernel is the intersection of the I sub N. However, we know that if you have coprime ideals, then the intersection is the product. And so what you do is you, you take I1, that's I1 intersect I2 intersect through IN. Well, this intersection, say by induction, is equal to the product of these, and then the product of these co-prime ideals is itself co-prime to I1, what we just showed. So this whole thing is just the intersection. I mean, this whole intersection is just the product. So this is equal to the product of the I sub I's, for the I sub n's. The intersection is equal to the product by the lemma. So we have an inclusion from R mod I1 dot 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 R mod IN into this direct sum. So we've proven half the Chinese remainder theorem. And we can't use finite sets in this case because, or counting, because these could easily be infinite. This makes perfect sense even in the infinite case. We do have this injection, now we'll have to prove it surjective. So in order to prove it surjective, again we'll use an argument like we did before, where you have one written as something plus something else. Okay. So in order to prove it surjective, let's prove that the element 1 and then all zeros is in the image of the map. The proof that we'll give will work equally well to prove that 0, 1, and then all zeros is in the image of the map, and so on for all the other factors. And once you have these in the image, well, it's clear that this map, if you project onto one of the factors, is surjective. So if you take this map and then project, say, onto R mod I1, then you get a surjective map, because if you have any element here, it comes from a single element of R. So all we need to do is show that the element 1 and then all zeros is in the image of this map. And then given any element here, you just take elements of R in each factor that would map to it, and then you take the appropriate linear combination coming from, say, so if you have 1 and then all zeros, then you take the thing you want in the first factor times this element, plus the thing you want in the second factor times the element 0, 1, and then all zeros, and so on. So if we show a basis for the images in there, then you get the whole thing. Also, you could think of this as it's an R-module homomorphism. If you show that 1 and then all zeros, and 0, 1, and then all zeros, and so on, if you show those are all in the image, then you certainly get the whole thing as an R-module. All right, so now let's show that this is in the image. So our goal, show that 1 and then zeros is in the image of our map. I'll call it psi. This map is psi. Alright, so the way to do that is so you have this ideal I1, and you also have the product I2 through I sub s. And we know that these two ideals are co-prime, so we can write 1 as something in I1 plus something in the other product. So now, we have to, using this equation, we have to just think for a moment and find some way of concocting an element of R that will map to 1 in the first factor and 0 in all the other factors. Now, this y, it's an element of the product here. So in particular, it's an element of each factor. So this y will map to 0 in all the other factors. So that's useful. In fact, let's consider what do I want to do exactly? I want to play around with it a little. Okay, if you take this element, 1 minus x, which is y, then if you reduce it modulo any of the I sub n for n greater than or equal to 2, you just get 0. So this is congruent to 0 mod I sub n for n greater than or equal to 2, because it's in I sub n. But what about mod I sub 1? X is in I sub 1, so this mod I sub 1 is just 1. It's congruent to 1 mod I sub 1. So you've done it. You've constructed an element that is 0 mod those and 1 mod the other one. That's it. We've now proved the general Chinese remainder theorem. which in particular works in the ring of integers of a number field. Okay, so we're done with that. Now, the rest of the notes for today are about, two things. One is how to use the Chinese remainder theorem explicitly with computer systems, and the other is some very, very nice theoretical applications of the Chinese remainder theorem. So first, as far as computing using the Chinese remainder theorem goes, if you want to do lots of computations with specific ideals involving the Chinese remainder theorem, I think the thing to do is to find these elements. Find elements of R that map to 1 and then all zeros. If you've found explicitly elements V1 through VS, so that V1 maps to this, and then V2 maps to that, to the one with 0 and then 1 and then all zeros, and V3 maps to the next one, then you can get any, you can immediately solve the Chinese remainder theorem for any A1 through A sub S. You just take, if you have, if you want to find an X, that X is congruent to A1 mod I1, and X is congruent to A2 mod I2, and so on, you just take A1 times V1 plus A2 times V2, and so on, plus up to AS times VS, and you get the answer. You don't have to do any work which involves, well, if you wanted to explicitly find the X and Y like this, for just usual integers, you have to use the Euclidean algorithm to find a representation of the generators of, so linear combination of the generators of your two ideals that equals 1. So that's the, you know, the usual Euclidean algorithm where you back substitute, or the super magic square thing or something. So you do that computation once and for all for your various moduli, where you find V1 through Vs, and then any time for those moduli that you want to use the Chinese remainder theorem, you just take a linear combination like this. Okay, is that clear? So if, for example, you had a massive 1,000 by 1,000 matrix, and you did some procedure where you, say you have a massive 1,000 by 1,000 matrix mod P and another one mod Q, and you want to find that matrix mod, you want to find the matrix mod PQ that reduces to it, then you don't do the Chinese remainder theorem somehow separately on every entry over and over again, doing the Euclidean algorithm lots of times. Instead, you find the appropriate linear combination of P and Q that's equal to 1 once and for all. That gives you this basis V1 through Vs, and then you can just take a linear combination of the two matrices, and that immediately gives you a lift of the matrices mod P times Q. And another remark is, how would you do this if you're not working with the integers? What replaces the Euclidean algorithm? How can you actually do Chinese remainder theorem in more generality? So let me say a few words about that. So really, the problem, as you see from the proof of doing a computation in practice involving the Chinese remainder theorem, is that you have to go from two co-prime ideals, I and J, let's say in the ring of integers of a number field. You want to take two co-prime ideals and find an X and I. This is an algorithmic question. Find X and I and Y and J so that X plus Y is equal to 1. Okay. So when OK is the usual integers and I and J are the ideals generated by N and M, then use the Euclidean algorithm, and that gives you a linear combination of X and Y over the integers that's equal to 1. In general, what do? Any ideas? So one problem is that in general you don't have a Euclidean algorithm in the ring of integers. There might not be a Euclidean domain. It's very rare, in fact, for OK to have sort of a division algorithm. But fortunately, there's something that generalizes the Euclidean algorithm, and it allows you to find such a thing like this. So if you you can view OK just as an abelian group as Z to the N, where N is the degree of the field K over Q. And likewise, I and J, these are just lattices in Z to the N that are invariant under the action of OK. So you can think of these as lattices L and M. So they're free abelian groups of rank N that are embedded in Z to the N.
another problem is to find some linear combination of the basis for L plus some linear combination of the basis for M that is equal to the element 1. And our hypothesis that I and J are coprime means that as lattices, L plus M is equal to Z to the N, where I'm identifying OK with Z to the N here. Okay. So what I have is that if you take, for example, a basis for L, maybe make a matrix whose rows are a basis for L, and another matrix whose rows are a basis for M, then together, this list of 2n elements, it's not a basis for z to the n, because there are too many, but it can be transformed into a basis for z to the n via elementary row operations, except you're not allowed to divide. So you have a list of n things here and n things here, and this assertion means that if you take this basis and this basis, put them together, then that will give you a spanning set for z to the n. So if you want to find an x and a y that so that this is equal to 1, you can convert that question into a kind of linear algebra problem, but over the integers. And the appropriate analog of reduced row echelon form and over the integers is something called Hermite normal form. And if you read about that in Cohen's book on algebraic number theory, then you'll see that you can solve this problem just by computing the Hermite normal form of a certain matrix. Okay, so not wanting to go into too much detail about how to actually do computations, just trying to give you an idea of how it's possible. So this can be solved via Hermite normal form. So this meaning finding a linear combination. Well, let me just phrase it as a very precise problem, so that will look very familiar to you. And to make it even more familiar, now I'm switching slightly and making the columns the elements of L. So what you do is you make a big matrix, say, whose the columns here are a basis for L, the columns there are a basis for M. What you want is to solve, you want to find some vector so that this is equal to 1, where 1 is some element of z to the n. And you can't really tell what it looks like. Depends on how you choose this isomorphism. So you have a linear algebra problem. It's an integer linear algebra problem. Find an integer vector so that that vector times this matrix is equal to the vector that corresponds to 1 in OK. And solving that problem, if you can find such a vector, then you take the first part of the vector that gives a linear combination of the basis for L, take the second part of the vector that gives a linear combination for the basis of M, and the first linear combination gives you the X, the second linear combination gives you the Y. So the question of finding an X and I and a Y and J, so that X plus Y equals 1, if you just take bases for I and J, stick them in a matrix, is converted into the question of finding a vector that solves an integer problem. So an integer matrix times an integer vector equals another integer vector. And this problem can be solved using Hermite normal form. And it's not impossible. Hermite normal form is really, if you look at it for very small matrices, very, very small matrices, it's exactly the same thing as the Euclidean algorithm. Form is, it's just the analog of Gauss elimination over Z. All right, any questions about that? Is it clear? Is it reasonably clear? Okay, good. All right, so now what remains is to show you some examples and then derive this really neat fact about ideals being generated by two elements. And that will be the rest of the day. Okay, so first the examples. Yes, please.
We want to check that f of j is 1 on the computer, right?
F of j is... Wait, what? Sorry, I didn't catch that.
F of j are two ideals.
Yes.
For the computer to prove that f of j is 1,
mm-hmm.
it has to write 1 somewhere in the process of some element.
Doesn't actually... What it has to do is it has to take this basis and that basis and together find their Hermite normal form, but it doesn't have to keep track of what it does along the way. And you have to keep track of what you do along the way in order to get this representation. Also, There are various tricks involving computing determinants that could allow you to verify that I plus j equals 1 without actually sort of explicitly doing the reduction. So you don't quite have to do that. But
actually, you can factorize them if you know the primes.
That yeah, for example, you could factor each one and see if the primes are distinct, then they're co-prime. And factoring wouldn't all require writing, you know, finding such representations. So you don't necessarily have to do that. I think we have enough time. Okay, choose one of Magma or Perion. We're going to show you how to do Chinese remainder theorem in one of the two. So, okay, wise choice, because if you look at the notes, doing the Chinese remainder theorem in Perry is really, really weird and obfuscated.
I think understanding output in Perry is really, really hard.
Yeah. Okay, good. Good choice. Magma is very natural. Actually, what's your preference so far if you've tried out either system? Raise your left hand if you like Perry better and your right hand if you like Magma better. Wow. What would you think of a system that had the interface of Magma but actually underlying it was really Perry?
Wait,
I'm trying to write one. If anybody wants to help me, please contact me. I'm deadly serious. Look, here it is. Look, you can do. This actually is using Perry, so underneath. But it looks like Magma. Doesn't do very much yet, but anyways. So okay, so back to Magma. So first, let's make the polynomial ring over the rational field. Under field x cubed minus 2. So I'm going to take the field q adjoint cube root of 2, a non-Galois extension for which we know the ring of integers is z adjoint cube root of 2. And I'm going to apply the Chinese remainder theorem very explicitly. And I'm following exactly the notes on page 65 here, word command for command. So let I be the, well, yeah. So we'll take the factorization of 3OK, whatever that is. I think, in fact, it's a prime ideal already. And we'll take the first prime appearing in the factorization of 3 times OK. And we'll let J be something that's clearly co-prime to that, namely the first prime appearing in the factorization of 5 times OK. The primes lying over one ideal are co-prime to the primes lying over another ideal. Okay, so now our two ideals are I and J, as indicated. And then let's use, so Chinese remainder theorem in Magma is pretty straightforward. You have a big command called Chinese remainder theorem, and say I, J, OK being A, and OK being 1. So I'm putting the A is cube root of 2. That's what I called it earlier. That was in the number field, but I'm banging it into the ring of integers. That is coercing it into the ring of integers. And 1 is just 1. Probably wasn't really necessary. So what this Chinese remainder command does is you give it two ideals that are co-prime and two elements, and it gives you a single element of the ring of integers that reduces to the first element mod the first ideal and the second element mod the second ideal. Okay, and it did it, and the element it gave us was minus 4. So now we're curious, does minus 4 really work? So if you take minus 4 and subtract off A, we better get something that's an I, right? Because mod I, we want minus 4 to be congruent to A. And it's true. And we want minus 4 minus 1 to be in J. Because minus 4 is supposed to be congruent to 1 modulo J. So just think about it. You don't even have to hit return to do this one. Minus 4 minus 1 is minus 5. And J is a prime ideal line over 5, so it contains 5. So this better be 0. And it, what did I do? It's because I need to coerce it into the ring of integers first, apparently. See, that would have, something like that would have worked in Perry, but, because nothing really has any type. Okay, so it's true. But that's a little disturbing. Minus 5 in J gives an error message. Even though you know it's in that ideal. So that's an example. All right, any questions about this? Yes.
Would it be the same if you coerced in K instead of coercing?
That's a very good question. I don't know. So you mean run the Chinese remainder theorem command right here? Like that?
Yeah.
Is that what you meant? Okay. I have no idea what will happen. Hopefully it'll just give an error message, but we'll see. Yeah, it gives an error message. It wants as input, it doesn't say what it wants it as input, but it says what you gave it. And I guess what it really wanted as input you can find by just typing the command with a semicolon. And there are, of course, many Chinese remainder theorems in many different contexts. Goes on for a while. I think we're using this one at the bottom, and it explicitly asks for something that's a ring int out rather than something else. Okay? By the way, in Magma, you have lots of different functions with exactly the same name, and depending on what the type of the arguments are, it'll call a completely different function. So that's just like what you'll see in, say, C++, but not in, in, I don't know, BASIC. Okay, so now let's finish off with our two really nice sort of theoretical results. So we're going to prove that every ideal is generated by two elements, and that we're going to determine the structure of P to the n mod P to the n plus 1. Hopefully in 25 minutes or less. If you came in late, the midterm, I will give it to you the Tuesday exactly 2 weeks from now, and then you'll give it back to me the following Thursday, which is 2 weeks and 2 days from now.
Will there be one late?
I think the homework will continue as usual. So on that Thursday, you'll have two things due.
Wonderful.
Sorry. I'll try to make the homework a little easier than usual. But you need to do homework on things as they go because it's really important.
Could you also make the midterm a little easier than usual?
Yeah. Because, I mean, it'll be easier than all the other midterms that I've given in this class. But see, the thing with your homework is that you have an entire week, or actually a week and 2 days to do it, because I'll give you the homework that's due on the 17th. I'll be giving that to you 1 week from now on Tuesday, the 7th. So you have a whole 10 days. So just do that homework before you can get the midterm, my advice. Okay, so applications of the Chinese remainder theorem. So let's see. First, I'm going to prove a harmless-looking lemma, and then the other applications are fairly easy, though somewhat slightly tricky applications of the lemma. Okay, so here's the lemma. Everything we're going to do is going to be in the context of O sub k. And in fact, some of it will in fact be false if you're not working in the full ring of integers, as your homework will show you, I hope. So if you have I and j non-zero integral ideals, so as you have those, then there's an A and I such that the ideal generated by A divided by I, is that automatically an integral ideal? Could it be a fractional ideal?
Integral.
Why?
Because I appears in the factorization.
Yeah, because see, I in A means that I contains A, the ideal generated by A, which means I divides A, which means that this will always be an integral ideal. No matter how you choose the A, with no hypothesis at all, if you have an A and an ideal, then that quotient's an integral ideal. And this lemma says that if you have an I and J, then you can find an I, sorry, you can find an A and I, such that this integral ideal is co-prime to J. So think of this J as just basically giving you a bunch of primes, and you're able to avoid them. So it is co-prime.
Wait, I'm sorry, why is A modulo I anything at all?
This isn't A modulo I, it's, in fact, it's A times the fractional ideal inverse of I. And you should think of that as follows. A has some prime ideal factorization, and
dude,
I does, and you're killing all the primes.
Ones.
Yeah, you're killing all the primes that are in I. I mean, this does have a formal meaning. I inverse is a fractional ideal. We defined it. It's a fractional ideal with the property that I times I inverse is equal to OK. And
we prove that, in fact, it's the set of things in K such that that thing times I is contained in OK, and this is a product of two fractional ideals. But conceptually, the way you should think about it is you take all the primes appearing in the factorization of A, all the ones appearing in I, and just kind of reduce the exponents here by that. Yes?
Is that ideal A divided by I, is that the same as the quotient ideal that you defined from those? Of like all the elements B such that B times I is contained in A?
Okay. His question is if you take the set of B such that in K?
Looking in OK.
Okay. Might as well be in OK such that B times I is contained in A. Sorry, is that what you said?
Yeah.
Is that equal to this quotient?
Because, I mean, that's how you usually seem like a quotient ideal defined, or
okay,
also like a transporter.
Okay, question? Okay, think about it, everybody. Is this true or not?
You already assume factorization, then it's, I guess, true.
We have factorization, we've proved it, so...
because it just means B is in A times I inverse.
Right, so A times I. So this condition is exactly the same as the condition that B is in A times I inverse.
Okay.
That's what you're saying. Okay, so think about... so what does it mean for B to be in A times I inverse? That's the same as B over A. So irregardless of that, this, it's easy to see what this means. It means the same, that B divided by A is in I inverse. And that's true because, these two are equivalent. B is in A times I inverse is the same as B over A being in I inverse. And this statement is also the same as B over A in I inverse. Because notice, if this is true, then B divided by A multiplies I into the unit ideal, which means that B over A is an I inverse. So yes, these two are equal. So it is like that. But you're right, the notation's confusing because it looks like a quotient or a mod, which I've been using. I think that is, I agree with you, it should be like that. A times I inverse. So that's the lemma. So, okay, think about it for 20 seconds and try to conceptualize what the heck it's saying, since it just kind of seems technical if you don't do that. So just think of it as a tool. It's some device that, given two ideals at all, gives you an A, and you can use it for something, as we'll see. And this J, just think of it as you're kind of, if you wanted to make something coprime, you just take the J to be the product of all the prime ideals you want to avoid, and this just says you can always find an A so that when you form this thing, you avoid those prime ideals. And this will be an easy application of the Chinese remainder theorem. Yes?
Does this lemma say anything interesting about the ideals of integers?
Like what?
Like ideals of, like if you
what does it say that's interesting?
I mean, does it say?
I don't know. Do you have any suggestions?
I think you could.
Okay. Well, it's going to imply cool stuff, so yeah. I'll show you some things it says. But let's prove it first. It's very helpful in proving other interesting things about integers. Oh, by the way, why is this completely obvious, say, in the ring of usual integers in Z? So we should always think about that with any statement in this class. So if you have two ideals, so in the usual ring of integers you have NZ and MZ, there's no condition that they're coprime, just that they're non-zero. Why is there an element, a multiple of N, such that... So here A is NK, such that A, or well, such that NK divided by N is coprime to whatever you want. Just choose K to be anything coprime to the generator to M, and it works. Okay? So So it looks pretty weird, but I mean, that's all it's saying. I mean, it's incredibly easy to see in the integers. Okay.
Why can't you could? Yeah, you can just pick pick k.
Probably.
Oh, so when I is a principal ideal, it's obvious.
Yeah.
Pick a,
that's right.
The generator.
Good point. If I is a principal ideal, you take the generator, and then you get this is the unit ideal, and that's coprimed to anything. So very good point. This is also trivially obvious in the case when I is a principal ideal. Right? Okay, so also, but not every ideal is principal, so it's not obvious. Also obvious if I is principal. Alright, so let's prove it in general.
Alright, so here's the proof, which I'm going to have to look at. So here's what you do. Is it P1 through PR? These are the prime divisors of J. First thing to do. And then for each of these, some power of it will divide I, or that power could easily be the zeroth power. So you just let n sub I equal ord p sub I of capital I, by which I mean pi to the ni exactly divides the ideal I. So pi to the ni plus 1 does not divide. And you get this because I is non-zero. So I have my PIs, and I've chosen powers exactly so that PI to the NI, if I were to take I and divide it by the product of PI to the NI, I would get something that's coprime to J. Notice that. I'm just defining these to be just enough so that if I take I times P1 to the N1 to the minus N1 dot 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 PR to the minus NR, this is coprime to J. Because I've exactly removed the PIs from I. This is an integral ideal and it's coprime to J. I've removed the PIs from I, and the PIs are all the prime divisors of J. Okay? So now here's what you do. We know that PI to the NI is not equal to PI to the NI plus 1. Why do we know that?
Unique factorization.
Unique factorization, for example. I mean, that certainly gets it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
No element that fits this module.
Okay. That's another one. That was how we proved this. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so these are not equal. In particular, there's something in... Which one's bigger?
P to the NI.
Right. So strict inclusion. So let's choose something that's in PI to the NI. AI. It's in here, but it's not in there. And we do this for each I. And we're just setting up the Chinese remainder theorem. We want something that's going to be AI mod PI to the NI plus 1 for each I. It's sort of a follow your nose type argument. What else could you do? So that's really stretching that assertion. But okay, so now we're going to do Chinese remainder. So use Chinese remainder theorem. What we want is an x such that, so I want x to be congruent to a1 mod p1 to the n1 plus 1. Certainly don't want it just to the N1 because it's in there, so it would be zero modulo that. So I want it mod P1 to the N1 plus 1. I want it to be congruent to A2 mod P2 to the N2 plus 1, and so on, all the way down, X is congruent to AR mod PR to the NR plus 1.
Okay, so that's some of my conditions. But remember, when you use Chinese remainder theorem, you can throw in as million conditions as long as they're coprime conditions. So an additional condition I'll throw in is that I want it to be 0
mod I, mod this thing, mod I times E1
to the minus N1 dot 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 PR to the minus NR. Remember again, as I observed earlier, this is an integral ideal. So I want it to be 0 mod this integral ideal, which is coprime to J, and I want it to be all these non-zero numbers mod these other things. And since these are all coprime, see, even these PIs are certainly all coprime to I times this, as we observed before. So we can find such an X. The Chiasson-Marin theorem gives us an X like this. So we find an X in OK such that this is true. All right, and now, maybe I should call that XA because it's going to be our A. Putting A in OK that satisfies these equations. So that solves the system that's indicated here. Okay, now we have to verify that A has the desired property. Okay, and now check that this A in OK works. So what do we need? First, is A an element of I? And I think I forgot to explain why it's an element of I in the notes, but...
from the last condition.
What?
From the last condition.
Yeah, it's from the last condition. A is even, I mean, it's an element of this divisor of... Wait. Actually, doesn't it fall immediately from the last condition? Because this ideal is a divisor of I, that means it's bigger than I. So being an element of something bigger than I doesn't imply you're an I. But if you combine the conditions, you get it. So this says that, so if A is congruent to A1 mod P1 to the N1 plus 1, then it's certainly congruent to A1 modulo P1 to the N1. Because you just, it's just a slightly easier congruence. But that means that, because it's in there, it means it's in P1 to the N1. So A is in P1 to the N1, A is in P2 to the N2, A is in PR to the NR, and A is in I times the inverses of all these. So we have that A is in, again, P1 to the N1, dot dot dot, A is in PR to the NR, and we also have A is in I times the inverses of these. And that means it's in the intersection. And remember what we proved at the beginning was that if you have coprime ideals, these are coprime, then the intersection's equal to the product. And then that multiplies off these, so that means that A is in the product, which is equal to I. And everything's an integral ideal that we just did. So I completely neglected to include that argument. And given our time, I think we have enough time to do it. It's actually pretty easy. So, okay, so now we're done almost, except we need to check that, the interesting part, we have that A is an I, we want to check that the ideal generated by A times I inverse is coprime to J. Okay, so one part, we need that ideal generated by A times J inverse, coprime, not J inverse, times I inverse, sorry. Coprime to J. So this statement says that P1 to the N1 divides the ideal generated by A. This statement says that since A is congruent to A1, which is not in here, it means that certainly A is not in this big power. So that means that P1 to the N1 plus 1 does not divide A. So if it did, then A would be in there, which would mean that it would be 0 modulo P1. p1 to the n1 plus 1.
So that tells you exactly what the power of p1 is in the factorization of A. So A is equal to, it's p1 to the n1, dot dot dot, pr to the nr, plus other times other stuff. That has nothing to do with the pi's. So if we take A and multiply by I inverse, well, in I, the powers of the pi's are exactly n1 up through nr. So when you multiply this thing by I inverse, the p's exactly get canceled out. And the other stuff, well, we know that you're not going to get something that's not integral. It's just a general fact about an element A in an ideal. So we conclude that the ideal generated by A times I inverse, this is coprime to the pi's. The orders of the pi's are all zero. So it's coprime to J. Okay. So we've now proved this very, very useful technical lemma. And it's just an application of Chinese remainder. So in summary, again, the argument is that you take each of the prime divisors of J, write down the powers of those primes that divide I, write down or fix elements in pi to the ni that are not in pi to the ni plus 1, write down a Chinese remainder theorem system of congruences mod coprime moduli, solve that system using the Chinese remainder theorem, then take that solution, and it gives you the A that you need. And you just check that the A works kind of by following your nose and computing some things. Okay? And we have about 4 minutes left, but I think I'm going to start right at the beginning next time, kind of to keep you on the edge of your seat, with the proof that every ideal is generated by two elements. So what I'll do next time is I'll come straight in, write this lemma down on the board, and then derive from it the fact that every ideal is generated by two elements. And then what we'll do is start the proof of finiteness of the class group, which we'll finish by next Tuesday. And I think I'll hand out notes on Thursday for the finiteness of the class group. Okay, so if you have any questions, we still have 3 or 4 minutes, so you can ask me informally. Yes? Yes, that's true. That's true. Localizing the primes that divide I. Okay, the divide J.
J.
Yeah, okay. Localizing the primes that divide J.
I plan on ever going to
So if you're making the primes that divide J, you mean make everything not in J?
No, it's not about
that.
Okay.
We're doing one prime at a time.
One prime at a time, yeah.
So, for example, I is going to the ideal in the position P1 to N1.
It just talks about how the internet's nice because it's a meritocracy rather than a connectionocracy or whatever.
That's right. Yep, and that is a generator. Yeah, I agree. Except the cool thing is, I mean, you're doing it locally.
That's it.
You do still localize, and then use the Chinese remainder.
What do people say about it?
Search together to go a global
network.
So all we're actually using here is
I saw the Black History Month display of Larry Summers, and I was like,
and of course that you have Chinese.
Yeah.
It was talking about discrimination, and then you read the little blurb with a picture of Larry Summers, and it just said things that are totally untrue. It's very funny.
I just said my mom told me what I thought.
Tomorrow.